It can be hard to define something as basic as beauty. Maybe a story says it best.
Every year, a bird visits a mountain briefly on a way to finding a place to build her nest. The mountain is enchanted by the bright singing and liveliness of the bird and wants her to stay. The bird knows she can't survive in the desolate mountain and is aware of how brief a bird's life is. But she promises to return each spring and sing to the mountain for the rest of her life. The bird says she'll name one of her daughters Joy and instruct her how to find the mountain. And this will go on and on and on. Each bird will name a daughter Joy and tell her how to find the mountain. So you'll always have a friend to greet and fly above you and sing to you. Years go by and the mountain becomes more and more attached to the bird, so that each year it's harder for the mountain to watch the bird fly away. After 99 years, as the bird disappears into the sky, the mountain's heart breaks and the mountain's tears become a small stream. When the bird appears the following spring, the mountain only weeps and won't talk to her. The next year, the bird brings a tiny seed to plant close to the stream. The root of the small plant breaks through the hard rock, drawing food from the softening ground, sending a shoot into the sunlight. For several springs, the bird brings seeds and the mountain weeps. Softened stone turns to soil. Grasses and flowering plants sprout near the stream. Insects appear. Eventually, the rocky mountain has turned into a fertile green place where the bird can make a home, and the bird comes to stay at last.
That's J. Ruth Gendler retelling the story The Mountain That Loved a Bird by Alice McLaren and Eric Carl. She loves the story because the mountain becomes beautiful through its love for the bird. Gendler's an artist and the author of the book Notes on the Need for Beauty. She told Anne Strainchamps that beauty is hard to pin down.
When I wrote The Quality of Beauty, I said, beauty doesn't mind questions, and she's fond of riddles. I had no idea how true that would be. Beauty will dance with anyone who's brave enough to ask her. So the question, you know, having written about truth and despair and jealousy and grief, and the quality I wrote about love became the joy quality, why I picked The Quality of Beauty, I can answer that and not answer it. It's a little mysterious. I do feel like beauty has been one of the most misunderstood qualities, and there have been times in my life where I've been in utter despair about the extra ugliness of things in our lives. I used to rant a little bit about the carpets in airports and the air in Xerox stores and rude people, which of course is more true now than ever. But I was also just so nourished and startled by the simple beauty that's in our life all the time. I just rode the BART train over to San Francisco and I saw so many faces that I would have liked to draw, or I was took a long walk and, you know, just a tree shadow on a Wednesday morning in cold, crisp air. There's so much beauty around us.
We kind of have to learn how to pay attention to it, though, don't we?
To...
I mean, I think part of your thesis is that, you know, it really requires slowing down because our lives are so fast these days. And in a sense, although we live in a very, very visual culture these days, hyper-visual, some people call it, we've almost forgotten how to see.
We have forgotten how to see, and we've forgotten how important texture is and the other senses. I think it's interesting because I write a lot about seeing in the beginning of the book, and yet there's an aspect of beauty that's beyond seeing, or it's the kind of seeing we do in our dreams. And I like to say beauty thrives on attention, and we have to learn to see, but we have to learn to see almost every day. And sometimes being an artist or being a writer is an excuse to talk about what we see, to pay more attention to it, to take one or two images and go deeper into them instead of just grabbing for more.
So when you write that in our time we've really distanced ourselves from beauty or trivialized it, what do you mean exactly?
Well, in the visual arts, and I'm speaking in vast generalities, and it's much more nuanced than this, but in the visual arts, there's been a great hunger to confront, to reject romanticism, to tell the truth. And there's been a maybe 100-year period where we've been really interested in art not having to decorate or carry beauty. And there are really good reasons for that. And there's also, artists are always finding things that others might dismiss as ugly as quite alive and beautiful. But having worked with kids for a long time, we are drawn to beauty. And there's no reason to reject beauty, I think, but more to enlarge and let more things, kinds of things, become beautiful. And so we've really focused on picture perfect scenery, beautiful young people, what's attractive. There's nothing wrong with that, except when it becomes so narrow that that's the only kind of beauty we're recognizing.
Maybe we need a definition, because it's such a difficult it's such a difficult quality to talk about. You know, the old phrase, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
I mean, we all define what's beautiful completely differently. There are probably dozens of artists who many people adore their work, and I or you might find their work ugly, and, vice versa.
Right. I think there are some beauties that are very personal and specific to a culture or to a time or to an individual or to an individual at one point in their life. And there are other beauties that are noble or majestic or connected with soul and spirit that most people would find beautiful. I remember doing a reading when the book first came out, and it was my niece who said, "You should be talking about beauties, plural, instead of beauty." So there are kinds of beauties, and I do think beauty is in the eye of the beholder, as is ugliness, and I do think there are aspects of beauty that are pretty big and universal, and that both are true. So as for definition of beauty, I sort of skirted around that. I think there are many definitions, and the one that worked for me most days is that beauty is the connection between our senses and our souls. And beauty is the bridge between the intimate parts of our lives and the immense wonder of the world, the wonders of the world.
Mm. So in that sense, really it has to do with a way of seeing. More with a way of seeing than with an object itself, maybe.
Right. I do feel like beauty is an energy that moves within and through and around us. It's not just inner. It's not just outer. I do try to beg off on the definition and offer definitions. Same thing with ugliness. When I was researching ugliness, I found a Japanese etymology that was painful to look at. It's hugely interesting characters. And what I finally found about ugliness is I think it's what numbs our hearts and our senses. And in that sense, some of the things that I tend to rant a little bit about are things that I feel shut us down or anesthetize us. I mean, I don't think the things that we've called ugly that are painful to look at are necessarily ugly. Hmm. I think they may be full of suffering.
Well, so just thinking of an example, I'm sitting in a radio studio, staring at a microphone. And
right.
I look at this microphone a lot. Nobody would call it an object of beauty. It's primarily functional. Would you find something beautiful in this microphone?
When something is really true to its function, I think there's a kind of beauty in that. So, yeah, I think a microphone can be beautiful in its what it does, what it offers, what it brings into the world.
My engineer is shaking her finger at me across the glass. And in fact, when you think about what this microphone does, what it lets us do every day, the people it lets us talk with, and the kind of conversations it facilitates and makes possible, then, yeah, there is something very beautiful about it. That coupled with the cleanliness of the engineering, form
right,
and function
right.
perfectly combined, yes, then you can begin to see something rather deeply beautiful in it, even though you wouldn't maybe want to hang it on the wall.
Right, right. It's a very elusive subject. At times I was like, oh my God, this is such a challenging subject. And it is my intention and my desire to keep opening the subject up rather than closing it down, because I feel like it's been constricted a lot. And it's a pleasure, even if we can't figure it out or solve it. So much of our culture right now is toward solving things. I think it's really interesting. This book was called Philosophy and Self-Help, I mean, what could be more fun? And it does seem like when we talk about beauty, we feel more of it. We get more excited about it. As hard as it is sometimes to figure anything out about beauty, it brings delight. I think beauty gives us a lot of delight. It can also be, like the microphone, connected with purpose and meaning.
Are there moments you remember in your own visual education? I mean, you're an artist. Are there moments you remember teachers who've taught you something, you know, really profound or really startling about how to see?
One of the most surprising ones is my high school chemistry teacher, who I didn't go into this in the book, but we really didn't like, and he was very short-tempered, and there were kids in the class, I think, who knew more chemistry than him, gave us an observation exercise of staring at a candle flame for 5 minutes and then recording everything we saw, and no one in the classroom wrote about the blue at the center of the flame. And that was so exciting to me. As a writer and an artist, I often was interested in extending my imagination, but just to be able to say what you see, that simple exercise from my junior year in high school, had a really big effect on me. A few years later, I was at a nature drawing workshop, and the instructor asked us all to draw daisies, and we all drew the symbol of a daisy with perfect petals, vague calyx, not really remembering what daisy leaves look like. And after a significant pause, he handed out real daisies. And these are not orchids or roses. These are daisies. And they were so, in that context, they became so exquisite, just to really notice the irregularity of the petal, to notice what the leaf really was. And that experience when I was 21, that anything you give your attention to in that way can bring you so much. You know, how many flowers have I seen in my life or in a day some days? But to really move between the imagining of a flower and the specific flower is fantastic. Mm.
Is there any particular daily practice you have or you advocate in terms of learning how to see?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm sure I'll think of something as I'm leaving the studio. I am a great believer in paying attention to inspiration as well as discipline. So I don't know about daily practice, but walking is as simple and rich as anything I know. I mean, when we walk, we can be really focused, but we're still receiving the world. And we can also, as we walk, be very attentive to the sky, the ground, the trees, the animals. So I guess I would have to say, first thing I would think of would be walking, because it is a rhythm of thought, and the world is there. We're in the world, moving in it at a wonderful speed.
J. Ruth Gendler is an artist, teacher, and author of Notes on the Need for Beauty. She spoke with Anne Strange Champs.